From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The noise around the dispute over North Korea's nuclear weapons and missile tests has continued to grow louder and louder. For more on that, we spoke with Dmitry Babich, who's a journalist with the Russian news agency Sputnik, who's just returned from summer vacation. Dmitry, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed your summer.
Thank you. It was a busy summer, but I hope you enjoyed yours too.
Thank you. And busy indeed. Let's start. I mean, we're looking at North Korea and a pretty scary scenario that's been shaping up, and I'd like to get your take on it.
Well, my understanding is that a lot of things will be decided on Monday because the United States will be pushing a very tough, I would say even cruel resolution that would not only freeze Kim Jong-un's accounts, but that will make it illegal to ship to North Korea not only weapons, but also all kinds of fuel, including liquefied natural gas. So if that resolution passes, then members of the United Nations will have the right to stop and inspect North Korean vessels to make sure they don't bring any fuels to North Korea. So the idea of Mr. Trump, obviously, is to freeze 25 million North Koreans into toppling Kim Jong-un, or somehow changing the regime there, or making the world safer in some other way. Well, that's a pretty stupid idea. I don't know how many freezing people you saw that were peaceful and secure for the surrounding. Usually people, when they're freezing and dying, tend to make some desperate things.
Right.
So I think Russia and China will oppose that resolution if they won't be able to foil it in the Security Council. Then probably China will at least make sure that North Koreans don't freeze this winter. But in general, I'm beginning to have a feeling that basically Kim Jong-un, who is very antipathetic to me, don't get me wrong, but he is creating a new system of global security. Basically, North Korea is becoming a nuclear power. There is no doubt about it. So the message of Kim Jong-un is, if we can't have a secure world with several nuclear powers behaving responsibly, let's have another security system, like the one that Americans had at the time of their expansion, at the time of the frontiers. Let everyone, even small countries, have nuclear weapons. And then the big aggressors will think twice before attacking other countries.
This is a Wild West scenario, in other words.
Absolutely. And the scenario that is still working in a lot of areas in the United States, right? So basically, if North Korea had a better propaganda, they could sell this idea to a lot of Americans very easily, because the logic of Kim Jong-un is very much like the logic of the National Rifle Association. It's nice when you have a stable government and a nice sheriff, and then you can make it illegal to have weapons. But if the sheriff is crazy, if he is Obama or Trump or the EU leaders, then let everyone have weapons. Because this is the only way you can prevent further wars from happening. We had more wars in the last 20 years than we have had in the previous 50. Look, the war in Yugoslavia, the war in Iraq, the war in Syria, the war in Libya, the war in Ukraine. So all of them, and all of them for the so-called just causes, for the regime change, all of them initiated by the countries that supposedly are the most civilized ones. So the sheriffs organize attacks against members of the community. In this situation, if the sheriff is so crazy, then let everyone have weapons.
So instead of Chapter 6 of the UN Charter, we should have perhaps the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the right to bear arms for all nations, and throw out the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Well, basically, the North Korean representative at the Eastern Economic Summit in the Russian city of Vladivostok, the forum has just ended.
Right.
The North Korean representative said that North Korea needs nuclear capacity in order to preserve peace on the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, but he's damn right.
Yeah, I mean, ask Gaddafi.
If there is anything that can stop, Mr. Trump from trying to make North Korea a better place by invading it, if there is anything that can stop the joint exercises of South Korean and American troops right next to the North Korean border,
and the Japanese, it's
only weapons of mass destruction. Obviously, Kim Jong-un, he looked at what happened to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. He looked at what happened in Libya to Colonel Gaddafi. Yeah. He remembered that both men basically stopped short of acquiring nuclear weapons.
Right.
And what did it lead them to? They were both murdered.
That's
basically, murdered by the U.S. clients.
And
so he doesn't want to share their plight.
Right.
And he doesn't buy, the promises and the deals that have been sold to him by the United States and by the EU. And in a way, we have to admit that he is at least partially right. The United States did not make any effort to make its compromises look better in the last 20 years. The Russian position, don't get me wrong on that, the Russian position is that North Korea should not have nuclear weapons. Russia does not recognize North Korea as a nuclear power. So saying openly that Kim Jong-un might have a point is politically incorrect and unacceptable for the Russian diplomacy. I think Russia will retain that posture of a conservative gentleman who still, sneers at the fact that, small countries are going to have nuclear weapons. But if you listen very carefully to what President Putin said, he basically made the position of Kim Jong-un sound more understandable when he reminded the journalist at his press conference in Vladivostok, look what happened to Saddam Hussein, look what happened to Colonel Gaddafi. Putin is not the first to notice that. Back at the time of the attack against Yugoslavia by NATO in 1999, the leader of the Russian liberals, Yegor Gaidar, praised to the skies, still praised by the liberal press in the West to the skies, he said that one of the byproducts of the war against Yugoslavia will be the desire of smaller countries to acquire nuclear weapons in order to prevent such attacks in the future.
Yeah, and those countries that didn't and or that surrendered them, like both Iraq and Libya, ended up not just with the leader being killed, but the nation state itself being destroyed. In each case, you have failed states where, once actually fairly prosperous nations stood. And so it's not just the leader, say, in North Korea looking at this and saying, oh, my goodness, I'm at risk. But the entire elite and much of the population, having looked at the experience of Libya and Iraq, has to say, he's right. We can't let them do this because look what will happen to us.
Absolutely. And I'm not even sure that, another conflict would lead to reunification of North Korea and South Korea. They have become very different nations in the last 70 years.
Yes.
And second, the example of Iraq shows that when you have a war, when you have a foreign intervention, the country simply falls apart because different ethnic groups start to fight for survival. And you simply have the texture of society collapsing, you know, being torn apart.
Yeah.
Kurds are for Kurds, Sunnis are for Sunnis, Shia are for Shia. In the same way, I'm not sure if the so-called military solution is applied to North Korea. It might lead to the reunification of North Korean and South Korean families. I'm afraid it may lead to even more animosity and to some very dreadful results. So I think that basically if a tough resolution is adopted on Monday next week, it won't be a step in the right direction. I'm afraid it will just prolong, it will just prolong the agony of a semblance of international law and order that we have now. Right now it's a semblance. You know, when the United States openly interfered in Ukraine, basically toppling the legally elected president and putting a nationalist, crudely nationalist regime in its place, when the Western powers openly supported an armed insurgency in Syria, there is no more international order. There is no more legality. Or there are just remnants of legality, which is not applicable to everyone. It's a selective international justice.
Right, like
so
the Wild West.
So basically what Kim Jong-un is doing is to provide an international justice which will be very dangerous, very crude, but which may be for a bigger number of nations than what we have now, because actually there are many nations that are very close to the creation of weapons of mass destruction.
So we're talking basically Kim Jong-il as Wyatt Earp.
Well, don't get me wrong. I have absolutely no sympathy for him as a person. But let me tell you an interesting historical parallel about that. When Stalin and the Soviet Union acquired the nuclear bomb in 1949, Stalin's arch enemy, you know, the former head of the last liberal government, Alexander Kerensky, you know, who had to emigrate from Russia in 1918, he was happy as hell, you know, and there are lots of witnesses telling how happy Kerensky was that the Soviet Union acquired a nuclear bomb. It was not because Kerensky became a fan of Stalin. He continued to be an enemy of Stalin, all the other communists and Bolsheviks. It was not just because Kerensky was a Russian patriot and he was glad his country was secure. I think the main reason was that Kerensky understood that there would be balance.
Right.
And another war simply won't happen because it would cost too dearly to start another war against Russia or with Russia's participation. So Kerensky was not stupid, and certainly he was not pro-communist. So in the same way, I have absolutely no sympathy for the North Korean regime. I hope that one day it will be changed or maybe replaced. But what I hate even more is the easiness with which new wars are started by the so-called promoters of democracy. So if we can't stop, the endless sequence of wars by other means, other than smaller countries acquiring dangerous weapons, then so be it. You know, let them acquire the weapons if it prevents more wars from happening.
You know, you have a whole bunch of history echoing throughout this that complicates the picture. I mentioned Japan, for example, earlier, and I wanted to make sure we include that. Japan is now one of the parties participating in these war games, which are, you know, rehearsal invasions. They are actual invasions that stop at the border, in essence. And, you know, Japan, of course, the history of Japanese involvement in Korea is certainly known to people on both sides of the DMZ because it's such a horrible experience that they had. There were, you know, so many Koreans murdered and the women enslaved and, you know, all horrible things. And this is remembered, again, on both sides of the DMZ. And when Obama administration started to bring the Japanese military along on this invasion, there was resistance on both sides of the border. So that history echoes. And then, in addition to that, for the Japanese, Of course, the idea that suddenly they would be a nuclear target, they have the memory not so long ago of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is a very real experience for them and not as surreal as it is for the rest of us. So with that kind of a dynamic, it may be hard for people to do this, but those that are looking through all of these, you know, various things at the possible scenarios for reunification of Korea at some point, there's the German model, where East Germany was essentially absorbed into the U.S. Colony, essentially, and so you've had all kinds of problems for the industrial elite in Germany there, and you know, many contradictions that perhaps could have been managed better from the Germans' point of view. There's also the possibility that the Koreas will reunify and become an independent country, and you would have the third largest economy in the world, and whatever the North is, it's half the size in terms of population, but it's actually a pretty strong economy for one that's been isolated from the whole globe. And if it were tied and partnered in one way or another with the South, it would be a formidable economic power on its own. And I think everybody's kind of maneuvering around that.
Well, you're right about the historic memories. I think we are living through a very special period, because the United States has been known for its wisdom and moderation in foreign affairs, at least in the post-war period, which is not the case right now, of course. Mr. Trump is still playing a positive role simply by mishandling the American foreign policy in such a way that it diminishes the power of the United States. Mm-hmm. The idea, for example, of Trump that the United States should not trade with countries that trade with North Korea, I'm sorry, but this idea is idiotic, because what is he going to do? To stop trading with China?
Right.
China has a trade turnover with the United States, an annual trade of $650 billion.
And it's not just that. We send them lawyers and accountants, and they send us products. They have the factories. So if we stop trading, you know, we're going to be eating lawyers and accountants and driving lawyers and accountants and computing on lawyers and accountants, because that's all we have.
So basically, Trump is so obviously bluffing when he says that, right, that China may simply ignore this threat. And the result will be that the U.S. credibility abroad will be further undermined, because there is no greater way to undermine your credibility than to make threats that you can't back up, by force, by enforcing them.
Right.
So obviously Trump is badly mishandling this situation, but this is not the main tragedy. The main tragedy is the ideology, you know, the mere idea that the United States has an ideal model, you know, West European countries have the same model and they should spread it to the rest of the world. You're talking about reunification of Korea, which looked like inevitable in the 90s. Now I'm no longer sure it is so inevitable. Yeah. You know why? Because it is becoming more and more clear that we're not going to have one globalization, as we had been thinking for many years. We're probably going to have at least two, or maybe several ones. Because there will be countries that would like to trade with the United States and with Western Europe. Already, I think the majority of the world's countries still want to trade with these nations, make them their main trade partners. But the United States and the EU, they agree to have normal trade only with countries that are their 100% allies, complete satellites, right? That alienates a lot of countries, including such powerful economies as China, Russia, and a few others.
Yeah.
So the result is that there will be two globalizations, one centered around the United States and Western Europe, another at least partially centered around China, Russia, possibly their allies in Africa and Latin America, I mean, not just allies, but trading partners. There are already countries in Latin America, for example, which would prefer to have more economic relations with China than with the United States. I can give you the examples of Bolivia, Paraguay, Peru.
Nicaragua.
The same is true about Russia and quite a few countries in Africa.
Yep.
So there are going to be two globalizations, and if North Korea survives and if it develops, it is more likely to adhere to the second globalization, to the Russo-Chinese globalization, not to the American one. And that basically brings these two countries, North Korea and South Korea, into different camps, you know, or into different trading spaces. Mm. Unfortunately, there are many examples in human history when belonging to different economic worlds meant more than speaking the same language. There are quite a few people in South Africa whose native language is English, but South Africa is not a part of the Western civilization as we know it, of the Anglo-Saxon civilization. So in the same way, I'm no longer so sure that North Korea and South Korea would really reunite, and I'm not even sure they want it, even if they pronounce it officially.
You know, you see the political and economic infrastructure and even the physical infrastructure of this, second globalization coming into being, the SCO, the Silk Road Project, the construction projects that are, you know, being developed, for example, high-speed rail to Moscow and beyond, and Continental Railroad for South America, the canal in Nicaragua, deep water ports throughout the Caribbean. You know, all of these things showing, you know, a pretty good outline of this second globalization and political infrastructure like the BRICS and regional ones like CELAC. And again, I mentioned the SCO, for example, the Asian Infrastructure and Import Bank and, you know, other similar things that are under development, under construction. And then after that, let's say that this is able to reach maturation. You've seen the same kinds of tendencies and trends, say, in Latin America, very pronounced. You also saw them in Africa, although they got blunted with the destruction of Libya and the placement of AFRICOM across Africa. But you have huge natural resources and 1 billion people in Africa, and huge natural resources and 600 million people in Latin America. And, the model of development that was offered by the West, essentially rape and pillage, isn't working. And perhaps this new model will work for them, and you may see them develop further.
Well, I think what is most important is not comparing, you know, whose globalization is more impressive. In terms of money and technology, of course, the United States and Western Europe are great economic actors. They have a glorious past on their side, and they may not be surpassed for quite a few years. There is another problem. The Chinese and the Russian, participants in the second globalization, they recognize the Western institutions. They see them, they try to participate, they try to have contacts. The United States and the European Union, for example, they simply refuse to notice the Eurasian Economic Union, which President Putin and Russia have managed to create with several former Soviet republics. And that Eurasian Economic Union is a reality. Yep. It has a free trade agreement with Vietnam. It has quite a few projects with China.
Yep.
So the American side is prepared, to its own detriment, probably losing a lot of money and a lot of trading opportunities. They simply don't want to see it because it reminds them of the former Soviet Union. Right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Yeltsin and the presidents of the former Soviet republics, they created the so-called CSTO,
yes.
Collective Security Treaty Organization, an organization basically aimed at enhancing security, you know, fighting terrorism and common threats on the former Soviet space. NATO doesn't notice it. They have no representatives there. They have no contacts. They just refuse to see, you know. So the East sees the West, but the West doesn't want to see the East.
Right.
And this is the reason why I think the second civilization, the second globalization will happen.
Oh, I agree with that. Where I was going was essentially
when
this.
Someone doesn't notice you.
Yeah.
First, you develop your own muscles.
That's right.
And second, since you have to survive on your own, you suddenly develop capabilities which you might not even suspect in yourself.
It's true.
And if you just leave several people on the island, even if they were not great friends, but if they are left on that island, they will find a way to cooperate.
Yes, they will.
So basically, I'm not going to argue whose globalization is better. Was there a chance for one globalization for everyone? I would like to see a certain fact, you know. Since the West doesn't want to notice the East will have its own globalization.
Yeah. And again, we're seeing this come into being right before our eyes. And what I was saying is that the coming of this also suggests a possible third wave, given the potential that exists in Africa and in Latin America, and the fact that the new relationships with the East that are being developed, both between Latin America and Africa, with these new relationships, you know, they don't come in and rape and pillage. They you have the win-win model that China is peddling basically as the way. So the possibility of development of Africa and Latin America into becoming its own power, you know, is also coming into being with the coming into being of this Eastern globalization.
You're right. With Latin America, since the United States doesn't notice the so-called Bolivarian initiative, you know, the three
right.
countries which have made an attempt, you know, to create an economic space of their own, a system of values of their own, you know, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Venezuela.
Yeah.
Well, if the United States doesn't notice it, then it will have to survive and enhance itself and become stronger. Because, well, if you are left on your own, if you are not propped up artificially, you develop your own legs.
Right.
These are all very American ideas. You know, the fact that you develop your own legs if you are not noticed, if you are not propped up, the
right.
fact that if you don't have a sheriff or a sheriff is mad, then everyone should have weapons.
Right.
These are all very American ideas.
Yeah.
What is surprising is that the United States currently doesn't seem to notice, doesn't seem to see the inevitability of these developments.
Indeed.
It is inevitable if Kim Jong-un wants to survive. It is inevitable he will try to get weapons of mass destruction, and he will be championing the same right maybe for other countries. It is inevitable that Russia would try to, create the Eurasian Economic Union and make it stronger if the United States and the EU keep trying to isolate Russia economically.
Right.
It is inevitable that Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador will get closer to each other, and they will try to survive on their own. Simply because, the United States is applying so much pressure on them, sometimes using other members of the Organization of American States.
Yep.
So these things are absolutely inevitable. They are in human nature. And it's very deplorable that the Americans, who have been such masters of seeing human nature and understanding why people would behave in this or that way in a certain situation. It's very deplorable that the U.S. officials don't see the inevitability of these trends now.
And as they come into being, they will be forced to. Dimitri, thank you very much. A pleasure to speak with you, as always.
Thank you. Bye-bye, my friend.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.